Mr. Chair, we did distribute our schedule kind of up through next week, and we've made some adjustments. But the main thing is we do plan to have a joint meeting with the House Energy and Environment Committee on Wednesday and Friday. So we'll meet in this room. It'll be a little cozy, but I think we can get all the committee members here on the dais. So that's for planning next week. And then again, a reminder, we'll meet with the Senate on Thursday at 8:30 and then back in here at 1. Today we have an overview of the lottery. Mazin's going to go through some of the numbers and start off with that. And we also have the director, Dale Penn, is here. And Dale's going to talk with you, and then he's going to be shuffling between here and Ways and Means. And may have to go before all the questions are addressed. If so, he's available to come back after 2 o'clock. So then if we're able to get through the lottery and address all the questions of the overview, then we've scheduled the corporate income tax. We'll start that and with the idea of probably finishing that tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mazin Madden with Legislative Revenue Office. Glad to see many of you back, and glad to see all the new faces, too. I, in the Legislative Revenue Office, if it's not income tax or property tax, that would be, I do everything else. However, different people take different attitudes about what kind of taxes. Many they would call them sin taxes, and that could be true, but we don't take positions of moral value on taxes. So some of them they call them fun taxes when you gamble, drink, and smoke, and that's the taxes. Today we'll talk about some form of gambling, the Oregon Lottery. I will go through a very quick overview, and some of the things I put in the presentation have some sort of symbolic meaning. The balls on the lottery represents the winning numbers, but the blanks. So now, unfortunately, the best of this presentation would have been seen on the back screen, but the back screen is not working today. Now, the first thing that people think about when they talk about the Oregon State Lottery is, of course, winning, having a party, some campaign, drinks, and so on, which, of course, we will tax later. but for the purpose of this presentation, I'd like to quickly go through terminology, what we talk about when we talk about lottery terminology, some history, what net proceeds are, what traditional versus video, and then what transfers, and finally we'll go through a quick overview of what issues usually lottery we speak of. Now, the lottery the terminology that is not difficult but needs sometimes to come out in specific differences. The revenue that comes from games is specific enough that it has a very direct definition, and it is distinct from revenue that comes from unclaimed prizes or interest. So when you see different numbers and different forecasts about the lottery, sometimes you will find that difference emphasized. Prizes, of course, represent the prizes that people take home and the prizes that people also play back into the machines. So net receipts usually is defined to be the game revenues. That's everything that gets into the machine, less the prizes. So those when you hear of the net receipts, are meant to be. The expense then is the game expense. It's the paper, the machines, the all kinds of the operation, and also the the commission is part of the expense. So retailer's commission. And also we put contingency reserves. When we take all of these out of net receipts, you would have what commonly talked about as net proceeds. A quick history in the lottery. In 84, it was created by initiative petition. It was then only traditional games. It was dedicated to economic development. In 89, there was legislative action that created the sport and the sport action. Now, remember, the sport action was a thing that Oregon had and not many other states did, because we came quickly into the sports action, and it was later sanctioned by different organizations of sports. In 91, the legislative action dedicated the 2.5% to counties. 95, Measure 21. And Measure 21 was significant that it had the added the education segment to allowable uses of lottery revenue, and it specified the 15% of net proceeds. And again, here we have the net proceeds and net receipts, and those, remember, the definition was different at different times. Ballot Measure 66 introduced parks and watersheds into the mix and gave it 15%. The 99, the legislative action of 1% for problem gambling. In 2002, the third special session changed the Education Endowment Fund to the Education Stabilization Fund, or Education Stability Fund, and dedicated the 18% of lottery up to 5% of the general fund. And if that is reached at any time, then the percentage drops down to 15%, and it goes to a different type of account, the capital matching account, until that point. However, it allows, puts also the conditions of what an emergency is, and how it is done by three fixed votes. In 2005, last session, there was the repeal of the sports action programs and the sport-based type of lottery. That in itself was also coupled with dedicating 1% of the net proceeds to the college athletic programs, and that is the case now. As of February 2007, there will be no more sports action or scoreboard. The traditional lottery games, if we look at actual numbers of 2005-06, the net receipts, that's the way they look. If you see that multi-state lotteries, that's Powerball, which has experienced a lot of big jackpots, and I understand the director of the lottery has a few numbers to advise you with this afternoon when he comes. Instant tickets is surprising also, that it is a 32% of this, and here's a 31%. You would expect megabucks to be big, but obviously it's not. At 123.6 million. That's how much we bring in to the cash register. Well, that wasn't it. Okay, that's from the previous one. Now, as we bring in the cash register, you can see that the screen became green. So the money started coming in. The net revenue, prizes, and expenses in a look, and it's always interesting to see the shape of how the net revenue went and grew and then came down. in absolute numbers, but then when you look at it in percentages, there's a definite shape for where the prize is, who is taking more and more of the amounts, as you see. It started in a small amount here, and it's expanding with time. The video, this is basically both poker and mining. The Digilottery revenue, you could see since it started in 91-92, that the amounts are truly staggering. If you look at this amount, this is about 10.5 billion with a B. That's how much money is churned into the machines and back and forth. That includes not only how much dollars put in, but if you win something, you play it again. So all total amounts. But that's a huge number. That's a lot of money. And if you look at the expense next to it, it barely shows. And then that's the amount that becomes net revenue that we take in. So
this is a fiscal year.
This is a fiscal year, yes.
So double that for the biennium.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Does the commission that goes to the vendors, does that show up in the expense portion that we're seeing there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's true. That's part of the expense. And that is still small. If you put it in percentage terms, you see what is still taking most of the money is prizes again. So a lot of money is being paid back. Prizes for the video hover around 93%. 93% of all the money played is paid back into prizes.
Representative Berger?
Mine was a rhetorical question. Who's winning those prizes? I'm sure Mr. Penn will tell you. It certainly isn't me. I've never scratched a dime off of a lottery, and of course I don't play video, so maybe that's my problem. But clearly somebody's getting those prizes.
You can't win if you don't play.
That's right.
But if I could make the valid point is that that's churn, too. That's
jeez.
Most of the prize goes back in, and then it's counted as, and then it comes back out and goes back in, and so it isn't just a single turn.
Becomes
Mr. Yeah. Chair, Representative Berger, that's absolutely correct. A lot of it is winning, putting back into the machine, and so on. However, that 93%, that is a significant amount of and the lottery seems to be able to attract people to play because it is able to offer them a reward of some sort.
of some sort.
It's called an intermittent reinforcement schedule. And it's extremely addicting.
Only a psychologist would call it that, however.
But that is what psychologists call it.
I'll use that in the next presentation.
Thank you.
If you put both video traditional games together, that you get to the total lottery revenue. And you could see at the beginning how small the amounts were until the introduction of video, and how then it just takes this magnificent climb through time. And that also is true for prizes and expenses. Remember that these are the total expenses. Now, the percentage-wise, that's definitely what it shows. I mean, that's that's a champagne glass of some sort. If we put another. Okay, lottery transfers. Just to go quickly through this before I ask the director to come and talk to you more about some details. You see at the beginning of time when lottery started, most of the transfers were obviously for a balance. This is that called the legislative free hand kind of balance. That's where we go and do all the appropriation out of the lottery. With time, dedications started, and here you have two dedications. That's when you given the bonds, the priority for payments. Then the education stability fund starts coming in. Parks with the red. Then the county is coming in, and now others, such as your collegiate athletics programs and the state fair and so on. So these, you start seeing more colors on the bars here. That now we get out of the green, if you remember, and get back to issues of different matters. And this time, probably it would be most opportune, Mr. Chair, to ask the director of the lottery, Dale Penn, to come and speak to you.
Very good. Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I did provide a handout. And
Mr. Penn, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I will. I'm Dale Penn, Director of the Lottery, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you today. And I did give a handout, so I hope you have that with you. But I'll quickly just hit on a few points and then be happy to answer questions. And some of these I'm going to go over very quickly because Mazin has already kind of talked about them. But it starts off with the fact that the voters did initiate the lottery, and that's a philosophical debate that the lottery really is not a part of. It's just our job to implement what the voters have placed into the Constitution. It is a constitutional agency, and the Lottery Commission was set up with the responsibility to operate and to spend and to budget for the lottery itself. There's a listing of other ballot measures that the voters have put in place in this constitutional framework. But the last one I'll mention, we do track as one of our performance measures public favorability. And right now you'll see that's at 63%. The vote originally was 66%, and it stays in those 60s. We try to watch that. We believe this is a game that is for the citizens who voted for it, so we try to keep it diverse, popular, have a variety of games available for the citizens of Oregon. The second page just talks about the operating structure. There is a five-member commission. This is appointed by the governor. It must be confirmed by the Senate. We have four members right now. There is a vacancy at the present time. One member must be a CPA, and she is actually the chair of our audit subcommittee of the commission. One member must be someone with law enforcement experience. And we have a retired sheriff. Third member presently is an executive vice president from Harry and David. The fourth member is a lawyer from Portland. He is the present chair. And as I said, we have an opening on the commission. The assistant director for security has to be a law enforcement person. Traditionally, what we've done is we do a contract with the Oregon State Police. And the assistant director for security is presently a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, and that's really the way that has operated since the lottery began. Our mission statement is on the next page, and it's very important that a lottery is operating at the highest standards of integrity and security to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon, commensurate with the public good. And I'll simply say that public good to us, certainly security and integrity of the process and the game systems itself, is extremely important. But public good is not just these good public programs, education, habitat, parks, economic development. But it's also doing this in a sales environment in a responsible manner. keeping in mind the issues of problem gambling and responsible gambling. And so that's what it means to us. We develop a strategic plan, and as I said, security and integrity is emphasized in the development of that plan. How we develop a budget is slide 4 or page 4, and it's just the Lottery Commission. We have a yearly budget. The Commission just presented the strategic plan. In our agency right now, we have different sections working on business plans and projects to implement those business plans, as well as a budget proposal and financial plan. We develop measurements based upon what we believe is doable in a year and will drive sales in this coming year. Those plans are submitted for comment to the governor's office. Ultimately, the commission adopts a budget in June, and copies of that budget are supplied to the governor, fiscal officer, and the revenue officer for the legislature. Page 5 is the one that's the most important page, I think, and Mason just talked about this, is that transfers, which is the amount of money that you actually receive in the state government to utilize for these four purposes, has increased dramatically. And if you add 06 and 07, that's a 06 is a finalized number. 07 is a projection, but it comes up with a 1.026 billion dollars, which is this fiscal year or biennium, and then you see the projections for the next two bienniums. It's interesting to note that in 21 years of the lottery, $4.6 billion has been transferred to the state. But as you can see, from this point forward, every biennium, it's going to be more than $1 billion. So we go in 21 years, $4.6 billion. Next biennium, it's going to be $1.25 billion. The following biennium, one. So that goes forward. Slide 6 is really a economic forecast slide. It just shows the different areas that the legislature has used these. Let me talk about slide 7, because it was discussed about bonding authority. And if you read the Oregonian today, there's a little article there about the fact that there was a presentation made to Ways and Means, I think yesterday, about bonding authority and the difficulty the state of Oregon is having with that. At the end of that article, it says one bright spot is the bonding authority backed by lottery. And this kind of details that. It is a strong source. It is stable. It does appear to be not affected by recessionary trends. And, in fact, the bond rating for lottery-backed bonds has been upgraded. And so you see that Standard & Poor's last month upgraded it to the highest level. Fitch affirmed our current rating. But Moody's has just now increased the bond rating and move to the highest level the mass transit bonds that we're supporting, or light rail bonds. So I think that is a strong source for planning for the legislature in the future. I mentioned on page 8 that we have a number of audits and our outside audits, and both just received word from Secretary of State. We are audited every year, financial audit, and this year, again, we'll have no material findings and no management letters. We have an outside security review by statute, and you can see the observation there that our security meets or exceeds the best practices of state lotteries. We do have an audit committee of the commission that meets monthly, and we also have a very aggressive internal audit program at the lottery. Now, one of the issues that was briefly discussed is really page 9. And I might bring that forward is because people will ask sometimes, well, what about this contingency reserve? What is that used for? And you see that this is a mandate that the lottery must be a self-sufficient agency. We cannot receive loans from state government. So we have to be able to pay our bills, and we have to have that money in hand to order machines or anything else that we want. And so the commission has established a $45 million contingency. Basically, $20 million of that is our checkbook. That's to pay our bills, just to float through as we operate. And $25 million of that is available as a reserve. So it's $25 million in case we run into problems, if our sales go down. This is our buffer to be able to meet the revenue forecast that you're given, that you're expecting X amount of dollars from the lottery. That's $25 million on a $1.25 billion transfer. So we believe that's a reasonable amount, but it's probably pretty small. It's a 2% reserve. I just highlight for you some key performance measures. Obviously, the bottom line is how much money do we transfer to the state of Oregon? That's the purpose of the lottery. The favorability, and then maintaining control of our expenses and trying to keep those low. Customer service measures, we've adopted those and have begun tracking those pursuant to legislative direction. Video lottery commission rates. Let me quickly talk about this, because this is one of those issues. There was a question already about where are those commissions for retailers. And we do pay fees to vendors, manufacturers. That's also a game expense. But I think what you're referring to is the video lottery commissions paid to restaurant, bar, tavern owners. And so 3 years ago, if we were talking about that commission rate, you would see that the commission rate was 32%, very high. And what happened is the contract ran out, and a new contract was developed, a six-year contract in 2004. The commission rate was reduced to, and I'm going to say this can get very complicated. We have tiers. We have multiple plans. When I talk about a rate here, I'm talking about a blended rate. Throw it all together, average it out for a year. And so the number in 2004 is 28.5. When I came on board at the lottery 2 years ago or so, a little over 2 years ago, then the line games issue came forward, and a request for $120 million additional was made, and so we went to line games. We moved this rate down to 25 with the idea that sales will increase. Therefore, it's fair for retailers that they would take a smaller percentage of a bigger pie, and that we believe this would even out. They wouldn't lose money, but yeah, they aren't going to make more money. And so 25% is the amount. However, at the same time that the commission did that, there was something that didn't receive a lot of publicity, and we call it a look back. Because what we said was, this is a projection. That was 2 years ago. I was saying that I thought sales would go up 27%. I was trying to be conservative, knowing that I needed to produce those dollars for the legislature. But it was a projection. And in reality, those sales have increased over 40%. And so, keeping that in mind, 2 years ago, the commission said, in June 2007, we're actually going to look at what happened. We're going to look at our sales in June 2007, not projections, what actually happened. And if our sales are $805 million in June 2007, then we're going to drop the commission rate again, and we're going to drop it down to about 23%. Because sales have gone way beyond what we had envisioned. The reality is the December forecast puts the number for June 2007 at $836 million. So I fully expect that we're going to get to that point. In June 2007, the commission will review that And then it takes a vote of the commission, but it's already in the contract. It's already established there. And so you'll see that in a matter of 3.5 years, we will have gone from 32% to approximately 23%. The other thing to keep in mind is our structure is such that the more sales you have, the smaller the percentage is for the retailer and the larger the percentage is for the state. So actually, as sales keep driving, this number, just by natural operation of sales, keeps going down piece by piece. In 2010, there will be another opportunity to revisit this. The contract will be up at that time. But I think we have made tremendous progress there, and that's in the zone that really matches up with other jurisdictions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
On that graduated scale, is that over the system as a whole, or if a small retailer is running one terminal or two terminals or is just doing the scratch-its, would they have a higher commission rate on those compared to a brewery that might have a whole room that's dedicated to line games?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, there is a process for that. First of all, no one can have more than 6 machines. Okay, but if you have a small retailer, we do have a graduated system, and so the small individual location, which is the vast majority of our locations, they do receive a higher percentage than the big operator that is doing a lot of business. The smallest actual categories that I have, it gets down to 8% for a retailer on high sales. So there is a difference there.
And a follow-up? With the reduction in the commission rates, have you seen a decrease in the number of small retailers that are carrying games, or has that graduated rate protected those smaller retailers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, I haven't seen a change. Obviously, there are a number that go out of business and other people come in, or there's sales of business, but it's stayed pretty flat. That is the other variable that the commission would look at in June 2007. If sales increased greatly, it was not because we increased a large number of new retailers. But we have not. We have had about a 4% increase in retailers in the last 2 years.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Penn. Following up on Representative Gelser's question, I remember 2 years ago when the legislature was talking about the subject of commissions because these contracts were up, that we had a pretty vigorous debate here, as I recall, about whether we could reduce the commission rates still further. And a lot of testimony came in about from the retailers, mainly saying we can't reduce these rates because people will just not want to do this anymore, and the bars and restaurants will just send these machines back. And have you found any? I mean, obviously from your projections, it looks like the revenue stream is not drying up. But have you seen anything come to pass like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, no, we have been fairly stable. That doesn't mean that it hasn't been rocky, and I'm working very hard to rebuild relationships with our retail. They are our sales force on this product. One of the things about this is that if we can do both, get a more reasonable compensation rate, but still have a strong product and strong sales, we're winning all the way around here. And that's really what I tried to put on the bottom of this graph, number 12, that discussion, because in reality, not only in reducing the percentage, we still had a very strong product and a motivated workforce and retailer base, and when we talk about changing commission rate, we may be talking about $10 million, $15 million, $20 million, and yet we were able, last biennium, to produce $200 million, $195 million, above the end-of-session forecast. And so that's what empowered those of you in the legislature last time to have a special session last spring and give $42 million back out in special session to schools, was that increase. And so right now, we have the best of all worlds, I believe. We've been able to whittle down commission rates, and we look forward to 2010 as another opportunity for that, but at the same time, maintain a strong base and have sales go up. So, and produce more money for the state. That's the goal.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Well, I think it's debatable whether we could have actually lowered commissions still further, and I was one who felt that we could and that there was credible data to say that 15% would still be a reasonable rate of return. And so the other thing I wanted you to talk about a little, I don't know which of you would be the right person to ask this of, but there is some lawsuit I know working its way through the court system right now dealing with the constitutional obligation to maximize the return to the citizens or taxpayers of Oregon. So where is that at?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, there are a couple of things to talk about there, but I'll just focus on Court of Appeals. In 2004, the new contract was done, and that was the 28.5% contract. And that was the one that was challenged in the Court of Appeals. And we've talked with Department of Justice about that. There are some issues about maybe administrative law review that I think this will be appealed, and that's a discretionary appeal to the Supreme Court, but I think that's what will take place. However, there is an issue. If you read the opinion, you'll see the last paragraph, the Court of Appeals says, you know what, this may be our definition of rate of return and what this statute mandates for the commission. We've said they didn't follow this, but this may be an impossible task. The reality is rate of return information for 2,100 retailers is unique to that retailer, unique to their lease, unique to the expenses in their area. How do you do a rate of return analysis for 21 separate individuals? That's a very difficult task. And so they say, you know, this may be impossible. However, that's for the legislature to deal with, not us. And so I believe that you may see some legislation this session that would strike the rate of return language and really put in statute what is the constitutional mandate, maximize return for the people of Oregon. And I would support that, but obviously I'm not going to be proposing it, but that will be something you may see or may discuss.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, if we could allow Mr. Penn to go to his other meeting and we ask him to come back after he's done. Not that we think that Ways and Means is more important than revenue. Far from it.
He's just simply learning how to be in two places at one time.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Penn. We'll greet you when you come back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would like everybody to remember that at the beginning there was revenue.
Yes.
Expenditure.
Income comes before outgo. Yes.
Perhaps by the end of the presentation, some of the questions about the retailer compensation would be answered. I have a couple slides about this. That's how much money. 0709. He said 12, but it's actually 13, and you know why is that. There's an additional amount that comes from unspent balances. There'll be about $57 million beginning balance. And then another amount of money that we expect, actually, the retailer compensation to go down. Mm-hmm. And with a few retail slides coming in the near future, we'll see how much, why is that. There is about $14.7 million for the business. And if you would see that revenue bonds take a big chunk, and the education stability 17-14, those are 17 some. Well, it's supposed to be 18, but it is how it works with a different math. Now, this is the largest number, and this amount is still open from a constitutional and legislative point of view for appropriation on either education, economic development, and maintenance of parks and recreation watersheds as the Constitution requires. So these are the ones that are not obligated by law. So some of the issues, if we want to talk about that, we usually have in discussion of the lottery is the line games, since they're a new phenomenon or most recent phenomenon. The payout percentages, retailer compensations on lottery expense, and the bullseye on the line games, explosive growth. Right. Did you hear that?
Is it lunchtime?
Explosion.
It was explosion.
That didn't work very well, did it? Well, in 0305, we were last time when we presented to you, whoever was on the chairs in front of me in the previous session, we were thinking that there's about $80 million from line games. That's what we were going to get in 0305. We actually didn't get that. We get only $60 million. However, we were thinking that in 0507, we get about 180 to 130 million. Actually, what we end up getting is $230 million from line games. 30% growth. For how long? That's the main question, and that was a whistle light. Wow.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Question, ma'am. Because I was there, and yes. I remember that 27%, and I thought, this is pretty conservative, because we purposefully were. And right. Clearly, when you do these numbers, are you doing net of the cost of... Because remember, there was a lot of discussion about setting up line games, how much you converting terminals, buying new terminals, and all that other business. So... Is the depression of the early amount reflective of all that setup number, or are you just netting it out and for some reason it started slow and then took off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, actually those are transfer amounts.
Okay.
So they're net of. But the line games introduction did not go as quickly or adopted as by as many retailers at the beginning that we thought. There were certain chains that at the beginning were not very happy with the new compensation schedule. They didn't adopt to it right away. Things took a little more time to unfold, so that's why. But $20 million for one biennium, that's the beginning biennium, basically. It's not that bad. But then once it started taking off, it seems like the sky is the limit.
Seems like.
And in 07, 09, we're expecting $270 million. That is almost a quarter of a billion.
Question, Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Maz, I've got a concern, and that is how long is, first of all, is Oregon that much more successful? I realize that we have more gaming venues than 49 of the other 50 states, okay? But and is Oregon that much more successful in its offerings of those venues? And is that why we're continuing to show those kinds of increases? And number two, how long can we anticipate that kind of phenomenal growth will occur in Oregon's lottery revenues before other states recognize that, hey, wait a minute, we're getting behind in this, we're being left out, we're left in the dust, in effect. Any idea what other states, how this plays out in relationship to other states, what they're doing with their lotteries?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, I think a lot of the other states are probably doing as much in trying to attract that entertainment dollar, if you will, as much as we are. The lottery in Oregon, I think, has been creative in the sense of what kind of games they're introducing. You know, they're on top of it. This is not the same game that you play a year from now that you will still play. And they're introducing new products. However, the competition, I think, comes mostly from casinos. gaming venues. At this time, there is the proposal of opening the, 55-acre casino in the center in Washington. That's definitely will pull some of the entertainment dollars towards our neighbors to the north. But the assumption always that the lottery will be able to introduce new games and be innovative and creative in producing this. Once we reach this plateau, the forecast does not see it as the continuous growth of the 30% level. It flattens out back to the level of growth of what personal income is. So we're talking about 5.5 to 6% per year once we reach this maturity of play, if you will.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Representative Butler.
Do we have some sense relative to the Indian gaming and Indian casinos of that sovereign source? Have they experienced the same kind of growth as they have added new gaming venues? And number two, do we have any additional revenue that doesn't show up here from those? Because most of those folks have their own gaming alliance. I know they do contract with the state police, but is there any state revenue that comes in from the tribal gaming activities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't think there is revenue per se outside the funds for scholarships, for example, or other dedicated projects or joint projects that occur besides the subcontracting with the state police and so on. But as far as taxation or revenue, I don't think we're receiving any amount of money.
And expansion of those games, expansion of their income, has it gone at 30%?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. The 30%, I think it has been. Well, let's put it this way. If we maintained lottery, video lottery as it was, basically on poker, video poker, I don't think we would have expected the 30% growth. We understood always that there will be a jump because of the novelty of the new game, and it's something new, people would want to try it, and then the ease of it. Not everybody plays poker. Line games are easy. They're a lot less rigorous in, you know, in thinking and so on. So I don't think that necessarily translates to all gaming.
Representative Butler, I'd just add that one of the things that we've always been curious about is what those trends look like for tribal revenue, but we don't have good access to that information. The lottery has periodically done kind of indirect studies of what that revenue looks like, but we don't get good information on it. So
Tribal Gaming Alliance doesn't provide us any
us with any kind of a you know, that what their balance sheets look like. They're under no legal obligation to do so.
I'm sure they consider it proprietary.
Yes.
Yeah. Paul, with regard to those amounts of money, though. Anything that they have for, in the way of an intergovernmental compact with the state of Oregon, that still comes through as a revenue source somewhere, does it not?
My understanding, Representative Butler, is the compacts are worked out by the individual tribes with the state. There isn't a stream of revenue coming from that. Some of the tribes have worked with local governments, for example, to provide for services. But there isn't an ongoing flow of revenue coming to the state from those compacts.
And was that true with regard to the proposed modification with the Warm Springs, with the loss of Kaneda and the opening of Cascade Lodge?
I'm not sure what those details were.
Okay.
I just know in terms of the historically, the compact we've had in place has not had that element.
Well, I have seen the Eco Northwest had done a private study of one of the tribal nations, and looking at that, the amounts of money that came back into the community, each year, that has increased phenomenally. And those are just grants, just outright grants back to the communities, schools, county, city governments, fire departments, those kinds of things of just cash grants have certainly indicated some rather significant amount of growth. And while I know that our key axis is the government-to-government relationship, which we have with those folks, and also the oversight is offered to them through the Oregon State Police. And we may hear more about that this session as well. They're concerned about why they have to have so much involvement of the Oregon State Police when they are actually governed by other, because they are sovereigns, they are governed by other institutions and organizations.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Butler, actually, Echo Northwest does this study, and they do it for all gaming in Washington and Oregon, and that's true that it's been increasing. But still, the 30% growth is the phenomenon peculiar to the Oregon lottery. However, if you look at the PDX travels to Las Vegas as an indicator, 350,000 people went to Las Vegas and back this year. That's a lot of people.
And while we're on that subject, how does that compare to previous years?
I think they've just hit a record this year.
I'm sorry?
They hit a record this year. That was the highest year.
So not only are we trending substantially up, but travel to the gambling mecca of Las Vegas is also trending up.
Although my wife will assure me that when her friends and her go to Las Vegas, they don't gamble. They just go for the show.
Go
ahead.
The video prize percent, as you would see, how there is a step almost in this time frame. And I think if this memory serves right, this is when there was the first time when we started seeing decline, and there needed to be a reinvention, if you will, of the different types of games and so on. And this was the first time when there was and Paul at that time was working with the lottery, and probably remember the 96 for the first time there was no growth in lottery, and then there was a reconfiguration needed to be done of how much you pay out to reattract people to come in. And that's the type of innovation that we kind of bank on, that the lottery will always be able to do to bring back that.
Representative Berger.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair Mazin, let me be clear. What you're saying was that basically there was, at that time frame, sort of a how come we aren't growing enough question, and the lottery said, well, maybe if we gave out more, we'd get more in if we did a different kind of a prize mix. Is that what you're saying? And it worked?
Well,
or what are you saying changed that made that jump?
No, remember, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, in 95-96, there was some slowdown in the lottery. The change in the types of games and the machines and so on have paid out, no doubt about it.
So there was a change there in the machine configuration. I mean, in what they were playing. I don't play those games, so I'm at a loss. Video poker is video poker to me. What did they change? That's a pretty startling jump. Just looking at your graph. So, what was the change there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is a significant change. And I think this change came as every lottery matrix, if you will, could have a different amount of numbers occurring at different times. So the set of winning numbers and how they occur is a statistical function, basically.
Okay.
And this statistical function of how much the space of winning that occurs by how much is all a mathematical formula that you could derive up or down depending. And that's what happened, for example, with Powerball. They changed the statistical formula, and that's why you started seeing bigger and bigger jackpot.
Okay, and this was done, excuse me, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes.
This is just with regard to video. They changed that configuration.
Okay.
However, you see with the new introduction that it is going down, back down again.
Part of the trick is to make certain that the mix of prizes, the frequency of prizes, and the amount of prizes is high enough to maintain the intermittent reinforcement schedule at a level that will keep people playing.
So what did you call it earlier, Mr. Chair?
The intermittent reinforcement schedule. Okay. A player is willing to lose a number of times in a row, so long as after some finite number of times losing, there's a win. And the question is, what's the toleration for that? How many times does it take? What you're saying here, I think, is either the prizes got bigger or the frequency with which people won increased. One or the other, both of those two things. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think another factor at that time was the intermittent rewards offered by the tribal casinos, where we're a higher percentage. And so there was a competition. So
now we're getting down. Thank you, Mr. Warner.
Thank you. That's probably a better alternative explanation.
Well, that was the calculation.
Get it.
So, and this is really the flattening of that revenue stream at that time, and we missed the projection by a fair amount. See, video poker took off in 93-95. We projected to continue at a very rapid pace in 95-97, and it flattened out. Mm. And clearly one of the factors was the casinos coming in into the more populated areas in the state along the coast and the Grand Rounds.
So it's much simpler than my idea. It was simply competition.
Yes, it's the intermittent reward, but it's what your intermittent reward compares to someone else.
Exactly, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, the lottery had to improve the reward, basically, in order to re-attract.
Representative Berger, I'm glad we ferreted that out.
Yeah, there was some mystery there.
Perhaps make it less intermittent.
All right. Well, since we got that squared, we have, this is just to give you an idea of what the growth has been in the different categories of both prizes, gross and net. And although prizes have been growing, if you look at a small amount and you just put it in a different context, the net has been actually growing the most. And also, you know, the growth, but the net is the winner in the growth category. Compensation rates. Let me just try to shed some light on that. The old rates used to be high, 35%. If you are up to 200,000, you hit the jackpot at 30%, and then it comes down as you go, and this is what your average is. Now, how does that work? If you make $1 million, the first 200,000 you get 35%, the second 200,000 to 400,000 you get 30%, and it goes that way. So, now in the 2004. The new contract, as Dale talked about it earlier, the lottery offered two types, the three tier and the two, and you could see it significantly was lower, and each retailer had to choose one of the two compensation methods each year. The average went down to about 28 to 29, but that was for only poker. Video. The line games have not been introduced with this structure of compensation yet. Mm. Now, with the 2005, when you put poker and line game together and you as a retailer accept to offer both, you have a new type of compensation schedule that you could choose from, which is four and three tire to basically getting you down between the 22 and the 26. This is the lowering down of the rates. That's how. They still work in the same way. If you make $1 million and you have chosen the full tire, you get first 775,000 at 29%, the second at so on, and it steps down.
Madam, is this per machine or per site?
No, this is per site.
Per site?
Per retailer site.
Thank you.
Now, the other issue that Director Penn talked about is if the two, and this is in the contract itself, says if you have exceeded as total sales lottery 805 million, then we look at it, and in 2007, starting July, you are looking at new schedule, and the new schedule looks slightly lower by about steps down, but at 1 to 1% at each rate, to bring the average to about 21 to 25%. So that's what is expected to happen, because we have hit that amount, and we're expecting to get about $14 million out of the reduction in the rates for the next lane.
I'm aware that the game from our side of the table really is to minimize compensation, while at the level that will allow us to maintain the retail sites and maintain the interest of the retailer in presenting the games and making the sales, as it were. Are there other considerations other than those two that you know about?
Mr. Chair, it's very opportune that you ask, because this is what you have just described is something of this sort. This is the gross revenue as it comes in. And what we're basically looking at, if retailer compensation is on percentage this way, on the x-axis, if you will, the higher the percentage that you pay for retailers, the obviously lower your net revenue. So if this is your gross revenue at this point, you're paying this much in retailer compensation. That's one way of looking at the retailer compensation issue. Now, another way of looking at this is the way economists like to look at curves, and say gross revenue is actually on a curve type of thing. And the curve basically represents the amount of work, the amount of advertising, the amount of pulling power, if you will, of the retailer trying to bring in, if there's more incentive, the revenue climbs higher. So at this point, when there is more incentive, as you give them more incentive and more incentive, your revenue gets up. So even if you give more in, let's say, the 20% or so, you're still getting more revenue, because they're still trying harder. The reward is as big as you're compensating them for. Now, which view is right? And that's if you put them together. Now, what do you have here? You have intersecting lines. Remember, economists love intersecting lines. We think we see God.
Inflection.
Where is that intersecting line comes? And where is that optimal level of compensation versus revenue? That's always a debate, and that, of course, needs studying and type of...
And essentially, that's the issue that Representative Rosenbaum was referring to, isn't
correct.
It? And we don't know where that line is, do we?
We don't know where that line is. If we knew, as we said, and of course, economists think we know everything.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would submit that that line is a Full Employment Jobs Act for economists.
Probably so. So we may discover it experientially without being able to describe it scientifically.
I think we will continue doing, in the coming 10 years or so, I'll continue monitoring this process for you.
That's
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. If I could say, however, that it appears that the 2007 schedule, which takes it down from 12% maximum to 11% maximum, I think the market will find its own bottom at that particular point. When you start having retailers that say, hey, we can't, not just threatening, but just not signing up for a new round, then at that particular point, you'll say, hey, at this particular point, we've got an unwilling buyer, even though we've got a willing seller, maybe we better work that around. So I think it's finding its own bottom gradually.
You described, Representative Butler, what my word experiential means. Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's, I don't think we have reached that point of intersection where we could point to it and say, this is it. Nor do we know, actually, unless we depart from it. And so that we will wait until we depart from that point, until we get back to equilibrium, if you will.
And Mr. Chair, I would also say that if we think that we've got the absolutely most optimum locations for these activities to be carried on, we really don't know that either.
Correct.
Because you may yet find that when that gets out there to the point where some folks say, we know what our bottom line is and we can't make it at that point, maybe somebody next door will say, you know what, we think we can. And you may yet find more opportunities. So I think it's experiential, is that what you're calling it?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Continue on with the experiential activity here.
Okay.
Thank you.
We will talk next session, Mr. Chair. Now, the final thing is to bring your attention to is a lot of expense. In law, lottery cannot have more than 16% of revenue as its expense. Now, remember, when that was only traditional games, that was difficult to maintain. As you could see, there was a struggle to maintain that 16%. Once you introduced the video, though, all things started becoming a different ballgame, because it's such a small percentage expenses out of the total. However, here, as you would see, the traditional still finds its difficulties, but it's getting back to. And if you put the two together, you're about 2.5% of total. That's not much by any means. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think we've covered all the things. I'll take questions from you, and I'll ask you to hold.
Economists just like to have fun.
You're having altogether too much fun with your new computer.
We thought taxes probably is dry enough that we would inject some humor into this.
Thank you. Questions, thoughts, comments? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the 2.5% of total being lottery expense, does it cost the retailer anything to buy into this? Do they have to buy the machine? Do they have to? Do they have a license fee or anything like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I don't think that it costs them the physical machines themselves. Mm-hmm. But what it costs them is the infrastructure. If you will. Where do you put the machines, electricity, people who would change the paper or have, you know, man the game itself, that kind of service. And basically they provide the location. And remember, the video has to be offered in a place where there is an OLCC license. Mm. So it is mostly people over 21, and there'll be all CC license for drinking and so on. So with that comes a certain level of of service and infrastructure that they have to provide for.
Thank you.
Something just occurred to me, and I don't know the answer. Does the state of Oregon restrict these kinds of gambling to people who are over 21 legally?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, by definition, because it only is in a place where all CC licenses.
Well, how about the traditional games?
No, the traditional game is 18.
Things you can. Okay.
18 years of
18 to collect a prize.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Along with Representative Berger, I'm also a lottery virgin, so. it's not something I'm familiar with from my personal experience, except that they're there at the checkout stand.
And Las Vegas trips are also for shows, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gill, sir.
What is the cost and the time burden for obtaining a gaming license in Oregon, and how often must those be reapplied for by the retailers?
The answer is behind.
Good timing.
Mr. Chair, President Gilzer, I think Director Penn would probably have a lot more ability to give you details on this, on the licenses.
Did you hear the question, Director Penn?
I heard licenses, Mr. Chair, so...
Would you repeat the question, Representative Gelser?
I was wondering about the time investment required for application for a gaming license, the actual financial costs, and how frequently the retailers need to go through that relicensure process.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, we do not have a license for gaming in Oregon. There are some states that have that. We have a contract that gives us a lot more authority and capability to terminate that contract if we believe someone is not appropriate character or operating effectively. There are costs in the operation, such as electrical costs and phone lines and different things that they must pay themselves. But there's a process in going through a background investigation. It's not so much a fee process. There is a slight application fee, but it really is a contract process rather than a license process.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, follow-up.
I know that in other states, the process of applying for the gaming authority or the gaming license itself is very time-consuming, involving mm-hmm. the investigation of family members, of any employee of the business, any director of the business, any part owner of the business. Is that not the case in Oregon? For example, in the state of Nevada, for a gaming license, it could take significant time and a full employee to follow that process to get the license. Is it simpler here in Oregon for a retailer to be able to do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, I don't have a lot of experience with Nevada. I know their structure. It is very similar, though. We may not go all the way down in someone's employee base. We will focus on owners and key persons. And in small establishments, which primarily we deal with, we don't do anything with casinos, but we're dealing with a small number of employees. We may have one key person or a manager, and those people are going to have extensive background investigations, but we wouldn't do that on a bartender or someone else. That's really the responsibility of the owner. But it's a very similar process, so.
Follow-up.
So, but what I'm hearing you say, if I'm hearing correctly, it's not, is it the kind of thing where the retailer needs to hire someone or devote someone to follow that process, or is it a simple process for them to get that initial or the ongoing, and I heard you say it's not a license, but whatever the permitting or the permission is for them to be able to operate?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, I get lots of complaints from retailers that they would like to see it streamlined. It can be time-consuming. I don't know that you have to hire a separate person to do that. Some people do. Some people have lawyers that would work with us. But our goal is to be able to answer the question, help them work through that. And most people, that's the way they go about it.
Thank you.
I think we're ready.
Oh, yes, sir.
Let me just follow up on that, if I may.
Representative Butler.
Dale, don't you give in the Ways and Means process, don't they have some timelines from the time the people ask to enter into a contract until the contract is granted? Isn't there a timeline that you have to indicate that you're going to give as a performance measurement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, we don't have that particular performance measure. It's a goal we have internally.
Okay, and could maybe just relate to Representative Gelzer what the goal is.
Yes, and we try to have that process be done, our processing, in less than 60 days. Sometimes that can't happen because they haven't told us about all the arrests that they forgot about or whatever. There's all kinds of things that come up. But and sometimes they just take time to keep the forms before they turn them in. But our goal is to be no more than 60 days, and we do a pretty good job of that.
Thank you. Mr. Penn, go ahead with your presentation that we interrupted in order for you to go to the other committee.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to hit the last two pages real quickly, and then if there are other questions that maybe I haven't answered, I'd be happy to deal with those. And challenges that come up, in Ways and Means, I follow the economic forecasters, and so they always talk about, oh, these are the challenges for, or the risks for the forecast. Well, we have a few. And again, let me say, my statements here have nothing to do with policy. I'm just trying to say that this forecast that is out there, $1.25 billion, I think is very doable. That is not to say it is not going to stretch us. We're going to have to really reach to get there, and we have some things that will hit us. Sports Action and Scoreboard is going to go away, and we're in the midst of the last game for that. We lose a player base, and the problem that it presents for us is our traditional games, Powerball, Megabucks, Tickets, Keno, those non-video games have somewhat stabilized and flattened. Video is still moving up, but it's very important that we maintain growth there. And so we're going to lose a small segment of that group. Possible reduced sales because of a smoking ban. I fully expect a smoking ban will be implemented this session. Again, the governor fully supports that. I'm not trying to say anything policy-wise, but that will have some impact for some period of time. I can't tell you how much, I can't tell you how long, but that will have some impact. Casinos. We have two that are somewhat out of our control, and 52% of our revenue comes out of the greater Portland area. So the La Center casino application in Washington, I saw an article this week in the Oregonian talking about that they expected to have a decision as early as this spring, no later than the end of the year. And a casino 15 miles from downtown Portland, that will have an impact. How big of an impact? I don't know. The Portland private casino is interesting because they just barely missed the ballot this last November. They are very silent, and they haven't said anything. They are prepared legally to begin gathering signatures. I personally think they're waiting until the session is over before they bring this forward, but obviously a Portland casino would have impact. The last thing that I would throw out there is that gaming technology is constantly evolving, and we have to modernize. And we've been able to do that with some of our video machines, and that's helped our sales. But if you go in to buy a Megabucks or a Powerball ticket, you'll see a little red machine there. That is a little computer, and it's really 10 years old. And it's like a Commodore 64 as far as its capabilities. And so our ability to build the traditional system, because that little computer runs the tickets, the Megabucks, the Powerball, the traditional games, will be enhanced. And we will be able to, because technology has grown so much in that 10 years, the cost of technology is usually cheaper over time. So we're going to save some money. We're in the process of doing that. One of the opportunities we have, and I just mentioned it, is Senate Bill 69. Right now, by statute, we are mandated to maintain a backup center 10 miles from the center of Burns. And We are working with the tribe and the county there, and I believe that, and the only reason this would come forward is if there is public support for this, but they're making an effort to buy that facility. And so we would need the capability to repeal that statute so we could exit that facility, but we have the opportunity of having our vendor, our new vendor, do the backup really at minimal cost to us, whereas now we put $250,000 a year into just maintaining this facility to have the capability to go out there and flip the switch if something happened in Salem. The last page I'll mention is problem gambling, and I think I tried to say, I made several of these presentations, so I think I said at the beginning that public good is for us also responsible and problem gambling issues. And so this just highlights the importance of those dollars. DHS is in charge of that program. However, we provide the public presentation of the 1-800 number. We do track the effectiveness of that. And we've done some things to try to, on our VLTs in particular, such as we have posted the hotline number on every VLT statewide. And we display credits rather than credits, make-believe, as dollars and cents, and we post a clock so that someone can realize, gee, I've been here for 2 hours. And we do try to work with responsible gaming because 2-3% of the population is at risk as a problem gambler, but here we have the rest of the players, and the message we try to give there is set a budget, set a time limit, have fun. Problem gambling is something that you have casinos, you have the internet, you have illegal gambling, and you have lottery, but we're very proud of the fact that lottery does make an effort to deal with this problem, and yet it's much bigger than just lottery.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember a presentation, and I'm trying to remember what committee it was on, but it was 2 years ago, and I want to say it was the Economic Development, Trade and Economic Development Committee. And you talked about the 1% there as well. But if I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I recall you saying that even though 1% is dedicated, we're not spending 1%. In fact, far short of that 1%.
Yeah.
Can you give me an update or give us an update on that?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Braun, the issue there was in the past, in earlier sessions, the full 1% had not been appropriated. However, last session, you did appropriate the entire 1%, and that has been very helpful. That program, as I say, is seen as a national leader and has been able to develop a full-service program, a small amount, but some inpatient treatment beds available. And so that was, I believe, because you did authorize the entire 1% last session.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Dan.
Well, I just want to follow up then with what Representative Bruins asked Dale. How much have you spent then this biennium of that 1%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilson, I haven't spent any of it, but those dollars are appropriated to Department of Human Services, and they run the treatment program, and they have a clinical psychologist that runs that. He's very experienced in gambling treatment, and so that is their program. Now, we involve him with some of our product decisions and marketing and that type of thing, seek his advice. And then we help publicize their program, but we have nothing to do with running it or spending their money.
Okay. Follow-up question?
Yes, follow-up.
I should have remembered that you were the district attorney at one time. I should have asked the appropriate question. Excuse me. Are you familiar, or are you aware then, what Department of Human Services is doing for the use of those dollars, for how much?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I can give you my understanding of it, and certainly they can speak to it, but it's my understanding, and I've seen over the years, that they have been able to expand. And so for the first time, they've been able to open up inpatient treatment beds that was not available in the past. And so they have begun the process of trying to develop really a full-service kind of operation for statewide use. But I think they were challenged to really all of a sudden plug these dollars in when they've been kind of reduced. And so they spent some time trying to build the infrastructure to be able to have the treatment. I think they're ready, and they will speak to Ways and Means or whoever about their preparation to fully implement their total program.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mr. Penn, I wanted to ask you about patterns of problem gambling. I know one of the things that was projected by people that didn't want to see us expand into line games was that more women play those games, and so that we would see more problem gambling mm-hmm. among women. Do you know if that's come to pass? And if so, are there treatment programs that are geared specifically to women?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, that... Again, DHS can really talk to that, but I can say this, that we have not seen any change as yet because of line games, but it's too early. The treatment providers say it takes about 2 years before you really see what has occurred if you make a change in a gaming situation. However, we do try to target our message to underserved populations. And so the treatment community told us a couple of years ago that, you know what, our stats would say that this is basically a 50-50 kind of thing, males and females, and yet it's like 65-35 with women being underrepresented. So what we did was, with our message for problem gambling, we focused it on women. And immediately calls to hotline increased by women, and more women were brought into treatment. My understanding is it's about a 50-50 kind of situation right now in treatment. But they said, you know, we have young people are underrepresented. And so we tried not as successfully to put our message out to younger people. We didn't quite see the spike, but that's how we try to interact with that.
Thank you. Other questions? And your presentation is complete.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. If there's any questions any time, I'd be happy to...
Thank you very much for coming over here. While you were answering questions, some of us were up here plotting about some potential ways of dealing with one of the issues you raised.
Oh.
So we appreciate your presentation very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, also the commission, the Lottery Commission was mentioned that it has, by law, a CPA, law enforcement officer, and an attorney. I think we have the same thing in the Revenue Committee, so we could probably...
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Amazing. That's very, very, very helpful. Excellent presentation, and I especially enjoyed the sound effects.
Well, thank you. We'll do more of those, Mr. Chair.
Look at me away. Paul?
Okay, Mr. Chair, we've got a little bit of time, and we've gotten ourselves kind of behind. We know you've got committees at 3, so what I've asked Chris to do is to start the corporate income tax discussion. And Chris can start with that today, and we'll go till about 10 to 3 to give you time to get to your next committee. And then what we're unable to cover today, Chris will be back tomorrow after Director Harchenko talks with us about administration of the revenue system. So
yeah.
Chris is going to, you've got the slides here, an overview of the Oregon corporate excise and income taxes, and that's what Chris will be talking about.
And we're not going to complete that today. We'll get started on it today.
Unless Chris talks real fast.
Right. But while we're on the topic you just raised, it is my plan to adjourn most of the time at 10 minutes to 3 because several of us have committees at 3 o'clock. Other days, not today obviously, but other days, if we have a large public interest in bills that we're considering, it is my current intention to reconvene at 5 or soon thereafter as is reasonable so we can deal with public testimony of people who have traveled long distances to come to talk to us. I think that's better than asking them to come back another day. But if committee members have other ideas about how we ought to handle that problem, if it should arise, I would appreciate their input privately about the scheduling issue. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I'm currently at a loss as to how to make the corporate income tax as fun as the lottery tax. So this presentation won't be as animated. But I figure if I can avoid yesterday's technical difficulties, I'm ahead of the game.
And you're ahead so far.
Okay, I wanted to touch on six areas, but as you mentioned, I'll only get through one or two of them today, and we'll try to finish up the rest tomorrow. The first is common terms. The corporate income and excise tax is rather complicated, and I just wanted to define some terms that that you may hear. So there's some background there. The next area I wanted to touch on is tax liability. And the reason I wanted to touch on this is from the perspective of, for two reasons. For our office, when we issue revenue impacts on policy changes, we start with the tax liability, and then we move, so we understand how the liability has changed, and then we'll move to how that liability comes in via collections, which produces the bottom line of the revenue change in the fiscal years, which are the numbers that the legislature is interested in. After the liability, I'll talk a little bit about collections. And then the next two bullet points are kind of issues with the corporate income tax. The first one is apportionment, how income of multi-state corporations is attributed to the state of Oregon. That's undergone some recent changes. The last area is corporate credits. There are a handful of credits that receive a lot of attention every biennium, so I wanted to touch on the credits. And lastly, this business taxation, wanted to briefly touch on the concept of taxing businesses in general. A lot of people tend to think of personal income taxes as being taxes on individuals, and so those are people, so those are the employees, if you will. And the corporate income tax is being the tax on businesses, and so some folks delineate those, but the system is actually more integrated than that. There are a number of businesses that aren't taxed on the corporate side. They're pass-through entities, and the taxes that they pay are actually on the personal income tax side. So I just wanted to touch on those. The first terms are the excise tax and the income tax. The corporate tax actually consists of two pieces. We have an excise tax and an income tax. Although it's generally referred to as the income tax, or at least I tend to refer it that way. 99% of the filers pay the excise tax, and only a handful, only 200 or 300 a year, pay the income tax. The difference is that the excise tax is the tax for the doing privilege of doing business in Oregon. And doing business is defined as any profit-seeking activities. The income tax, on the other hand, is the tax on businesses that are not doing business in Oregon, but they have Oregon-sourced income. The unitary reporting requirement essentially states that any affiliated group of corporations that file a federal consolidated return must do so for Oregon as well. That's essentially corporations that are closely linked together, they file one return at the federal level rather than separate returns for each corporation. Apportionment and allocation. Here the distinction is, again, on the multi-state corporations. For any corporation that only does business within one state, so we have a corporation A only does business within the state of Oregon, all of its income is taxed by the state of Oregon. For a corporation that does business in more than one state, they will be taxed by all of those states. And so one of the steps in that, the tax calculation process, is how much of that income, that corporation's income, can be taxed by Oregon. And apportionment is simply the method by which the business income is attributed to Oregon. And that's a section I'll get to more on detail later. Allocation refers to non-business income, any income that a corporation has that is not related to its main operation is allocated to its source. Examples of this would be interest income or capital gains. They won't be apportioned across the states. They will be attributed to wherever the source of that income is.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Where's the source of a capital gain?
Well, if a corporation owns some property, say in the state of Oregon or in the state of Idaho, and then they sell that property, the gain from that property would be attributed to that site.
And if the corporation sells stock in another corporation that has business generally?
Then I'll have to get back to you on that
okay.
one. I'm not sure how.
I'm not sure I need to know the answer.
Follows the site of the corporation's headquarters.
Okay.
Typically.
Okay. We got an answer. Thank you.
C corporation and S corporation. It refers to the it's a type of corporation. The corporate income tax. Well, there are about 80,000 or so, 85,000 corporations in Oregon. And about 30,000 of them are C corporations, and these are the big, they tend to be the large corporations. And S corporations are, by definition, they have to meet certain small business requirements. A couple of differences between the two, the capital structure of the firms are different. A C corporation can have different kinds of stock and can have any number of shareholders. An S corporation is limited to 100 shareholders and only one class of stock. And an S corporation is one of the pass-through entities, so that any income earned by the S corporation is passed through to its shareholders, and then they are taxed on the individual side. Carry back and carry forward, these have to do with things like operating loss deductions. A business that has an operating loss in 1 year may carry forward that loss to subsequent tax years, and the operating loss deduction, they may do so for 15 years. So if a business has a loss in 05, they could carry forward that loss to subsequent years to offset income earned in those years. Another area where these are relevant are capital losses. Capital losses can be carried back for 3 years, meaning if a capital loss has occurred, a corporation can file an amended return for a prior tax year and offset any income or gain that they had that prior year, or it can be carried forward for up to 5 years. Moving on to tax liability, the first slide I just wanted to show is Oregon's tax rate. These are all of the state's tax rates, or the ranking of corporation tax rates for all the 47 states that have a corporate income tax, and Oregon is somewhere in the middle. We're ranked about 30th, and our rate is 6.6%. The history of the corporate tax liability has been fairly volatile, and we can see here how it's changed from 1990 through 2005. And these are the tax years of the corporations. And a corporation can have choose its fiscal year wherever it wants to throughout the course of the year. It can line up with the calendar year, or it can start on July 1 or wherever. And the tax year that is determined here is the year in which their fiscal year starts is how they get assigned to the tax year. And so the pink line is the income before the kicker, and then the blue line shows the kicks related to the kickers, the two kickers in the mid-90s, and then the current kicker in 05. Looking at the annual changes in the tax liability, this highlights how dramatic the changes can be from year to year. Over this time period throughout the 90s, the average annual change was about 7%, but rarely was the change actually that amount. It's gone up by 50% as well as declines by 30%. And here in the mid-90s, we had an up and down motion. And we can see over this period, the longest stretch that we had of continual increases was 4 years, and right now with the projections for 05, we're at 3 years in a row of increases. Looking at the industrial sectors for the corporations, we can see where the concentration of the number of businesses and where the tax comes from. The line here is the Oregon tax. The total tax liability for 2004 was $309 million. And the largest sector was wholesale trade at about $65 million, and then finance was second. Manufacturing was fourth at about $50 million. And then once we get to the fifth largest sector in terms of tax liability, that's construction, but the liability falls down to $10 million. And so all of the other sectors are fairly relatively small players in terms of liability. Although in terms of corporations, construction is the highest. Professional, scientific, and technical services also has a substantial number of businesses, as well as wholesale trade. Looking at the size of the firms, here I have a chart of just the corporations with positive taxable income, and we can see here that that total number of returns is just over 12,000. Now, for the C corporations in total, on the prior slide, the total number of returns was about 34,000. The difference there, the 20,000 are C corporations that had did not have a positive tax liability or positive taxable income, and they paid the minimum tax. If I included them in this chart, this pie went to, it became really hard to see, and this is part of what I wanted to highlight here. The top 1% of companies, I mean the companies with $5 million of taxable income or more represent only 1% of all firms. Mm-hmm. And 80% of the firms have taxable income of up to only $100,000. Now this pie chart here, this 1% of firms here is broken out into three groups. We have 5 to 10 million, 10 to 25 million, and then greater than $25 million of taxable income. And together, that 1% of firms represents about 62% of the total liability. So again, the corporate income tax, the theme here is the concentration of the tax within a relatively small number of firms.
Now, isn't that true that to some extent this is the picture is skewed by the fact, if I understand it correctly, by the fact that many small businesses that are C corporations actually pay out all of their income as wages to the principals at the end of the year, and therefore don't have any net income within the corporation. Instead, they pay personal income taxes on those profits. Is that a fair characterization of some of these smaller businesses? Or?
Mr. Chair, these are C corporations.
Correct.
So even the 33,000, the number of 33,000 is C corporations.
Correct.
Right. So if you're looking at all corporations in general, this would definitely be skewed. If I tried to throw in all of the S corporations,
right,
that would be adding 50,000 returns here that wouldn't have any taxable
income.
Well,
a fair number of professional corporations are C corporations.
Right. They're here, and they're part of those other, the smaller ones.
Right. Thank you.
Yes. And here is just a chart showing, again, by the taxable income categories, the average liability of those firms. The $11 here is mostly the minimum tax. A few corporations pay a little bit more than that. But it goes up dramatically, as expected, because this is a graph by taxable income, so the firms with the most taxable income have the largest tax liability. But again, this is that 1% of firms that have positive taxable income, and their average liability is $3.1 million. Now, there's also a lot of interest in Oregon only, taking all of the C corporations and then categorizing them as to Oregon only or multi-state corporations. And so this chart, there are two charts here. This is for the returns, and the next chart is for liability. But this shows that of all of the C corporations, about 65% of them are Oregon only, and 35% of them are multi-state. And then we have the breakdown by size. Essentially, the larger the company gets, the less likely it is to be Oregon only. And again, I think that makes a lot of intuitive sense. As a corporation grows, it's going to expand. It's not going to restrict itself to political boundaries. Um, Oh, in terms of number, there are about 22,000 Oregon-only companies, and 12,000 multi-state. And of those 12,000 multi-state, about 1,500 are domiciled in Oregon. Looking at the percent of tax, we can see that those 65% of Oregon-only companies account for about 15% of the tax, whereas the multi-state corporations account for about 85% of the tax. And again, then the multi-state corporations that are domiciled in Oregon account for about $45 million of that tax. The multi-state is about $270 million. The last liability associated slide I wanted to show you was pertaining to the corporate minimum tax. And the bars here with the lines in them represent the number of S corporations that pay the minimum tax. And that's about 99%. Virtually all S corporations just pay the minimum tax because the income is passed through to the personal side. The number of C corporations that pay the minimum tax has stayed in the low 20,000 range for the past 10 years or so. We're actually seeing a slight decline in the number of C corporations in total. The red line represents the percent of C corporations that pay the minimum tax, and that line went up dramatically over the past few years, although it did level off in 03 and declined in 04, just a hair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rosenbaum.
I know we're probably going to run out of time, but I did, Chris, I don't know if you were listening to our hearing that we had, a joint hearing this morning with the Senate Revenue Committee, and we're hearing from the governor. And,
yes.
And a question was asked about a proposal to raise the corporate minimum tax. I think basically the question was, well, how can you say that these are companies that could pay more, because if they were profitable, they wouldn't be paying the corporate minimum at all. They would be being taxed under the corporate income tax, which I assume they meant on profits that they were making. So could you kind of address that, whether there is something about the corporate minimum that would say that all these companies are not profitable, or they wouldn't be paying, they would be being taxed not under the minimum but under the corporate income tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, if I think I'm tracking with your question, but if not, please let me know. The tax is on the taxable is a function of taxable income. So the corporations that are only paying the minimum tax essentially have no taxable income, because whatever that taxable income is, multiplied by 6.6%, that's their gross tax, and then they reduce their credit. So it's possible you can have a profitable company and actually has gross tax, but with their credits, they reduce their liability down to zero, and those are the people that pay the minimum tax. One of the issues pertaining to the taxation of the businesses is some of the foundation principles of the business taxation, and you have the two guiding principles: your ability to pay, which is kind of what we have now, with the higher the income, the more tax they pay, or benefits received. And if you were to go to some more minimum tax, it would be kind of blending in the two, to say that even if you don't have positive taxable income, there's a benefit from operating in the state of Oregon, and so it would be kind of taxing on that principle.
I guess if I can follow up, Mr. Chair, it maybe there were some misconceptions that were inherent in this question, but I think that the questioner was sort of trying to make a distinction between profitable companies would be paying the corporate income tax, as opposed to the ones that are paying the minimum, and that all these companies paying the corporate minimum, which I think is most businesses in Oregon, that they were not making any money, or they were losing money, and otherwise they'd be showing up on the other side of the balance sheet. From what you're saying, though, you could have a profitable company, and if you had a good accountant and were making a good use of tax credits, you might end up owing nothing just by virtue of how the credits balanced out with what you would otherwise owe. Or maybe, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's something we're just missing about this equation.
Mr. Chair, Madam, or Representative Rosenbaum, the issues become very complicated in that you have a lot of definitions of income. You have book income on the corporations, and then you have the taxable income that ultimately what you get down to on the tax return. So I'm not sure if everybody's on the same page in terms of the notion of what do we mean by a profitable business. I don't know if it's necessarily the case that if positive taxable income relates to a profitable business. Another thing, if I could add, is just the notion of businesses in general and the taxation. When we think of all businesses, a lot of the corporations that file these returns aren't necessarily the Coca-Colas and the Pepsis and those kinds of companies. And a lot of the businesses do pay taxes through the personal side as well. And that's what I want to get to eventually at the end here in terms of the concept of business taxation, to try and just provide a little bit of insight into the notion of business taxation and as a policy discussion, what is the appropriate way to tax businesses.
Well, I'd ask the committee to hold balance of the questions until tomorrow, when we will begin with those questions and then proceed with tax collections. Thank you very much for being here today. We are adjourned.